I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Later in the hour, we talk about the evolution of folk music and the long history of live folk music performances in Woods Hole. But first, most people are familiar with the game of Frisbee, but how much do you know about Ultimate Frisbee? Team flying disc games started out using pie tins decades before the plastic Frisbee was introduced. The first sanctioned Ultimate Frisbee game was played in 1968 at Columbia High School in Maplewood, New Jersey. We'll get to the roots of the game, but first we go to Syracuse University, where Chris McLinn gives us some insight into the growing popularity of Ultimate Frisbee, how a lack of officials has come to define the sport, and how it's evolving now that it's reach the professional level.
Ultimate Frisbee is a fast-growing global sport that is now played almost year-round by people of all ages. What separates Ultimate from most other sports is the lack of referees. The sport is based on the honor code and relies on self-officiation. What this means is players make their own calls on the field. My name is Chris McGlynn, and I am one of the captains of the Syracuse men's Ultimate Frisbee team. This is my sixth year playing this relatively unknown sport. Getting used to self-officiation took a little bit of time for me, but it made Ultimate even more interesting. One of my coaches growing up was Anthony Nunez. He spent 13 years coaching at Columbia High School in Maplewood, New Jersey. To him, the absence of referees was a great thing for young kids.
Well, I think it's important that the youth, one, learn the rules, and two, is it gives them the opportunity to problem solve by debate slash argument.
Nunez says it also teaches young athletes the value of sportsmanship, which is more likely to be forgotten at the professional level.
Slam, as you guys are.
One man who's had a lot of experience overseeing sportsmanship at a professional level is former National Basketball League Commissioner Rick Burton, who still remembers his encounters with the violations of integrity in professional sports.
Most of my owners then wanted simply to win the championship, and they were willing to pay money under the table to get better players on their team in order to possibly win the championship.
This was one of Burton's greatest challenges as he fought for the perception of integrity.
Because if the fans don't believe that the games are even, that it's a level playing field, the fans will desert you because they're being hoodwinked, or, you know, they're being deceived.
Fans hold an inordinate amount of power in professional sports. Many kids who grow up as fans of professional sports dream of playing them one day, myself included. Most have to ditch the dream, though, when they realize that they will not actually make it to the highest level of competition. I'm one of the few who didn't have to give it up.
Throw it back up to McGlynn. McGlynn out in front of the defense there. That time, the foot race against O'Connor, and first MLU point for Christopher McGlynn in his first MLU game. He picks up the assist to Steven Wilson, and now it's 4-2 and plenty of smiles here from the crowd in Orange, New Jersey.
That was Dan Hilton of Major League Ultimate describing a play from my first game as a professional athlete. In 2013, Major League Ultimate popped up. In addition to playing for Syracuse, this is my first season with the MLU's New York Rumble, once again playing for Nunez. At its core, the game is still the same, but I am no longer making the calls. MLU Commissioner Nick Darling says the inclusion of officials on the field goes beyond just the experience of players.
Being able to incorporate the needs and the desire of fans into the experience.
Darling also pointed out that referees solve a number of logistical problems.
Couldn't play in big crowded stadiums because, frankly, you're never going to hear a pick call even over 2,000 or 3,000 people in the stands.
Darling says he would like to see officials at the youth level. Nunez opposes that idea, but agreed that they are necessary in the pros.
When you get to the professional level, it's when games start to matter a little differently, and I agree with, I think that you should have it where it's whatever keeps the game the most fair.
Darling and Nunez are on the same page in that they just want the game to be fair. It seems like what is fair, though, is open for interpretation. I'm Chris McLinn.
Joining us now in studio is David Gessner. His new book is Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth. All of that ringing a bell there as you're listening to Chris McLinn, right?
It rung many bells, yes. Thanks,
so Benny. Talk about how you got involved in Ultimate Frisbee.
I didn't know what the hell it was either at first. Like a lot of people, you know, one of the issues with Ultimate is you're always kind of in this defensive position of people not knowing. And when I was playing, I'd dedicate my life to it, and then people would say, is that the thing you do with dogs?
Mm-hmm.
Now they tend to say, oh, we have a course near our house. They're talking about Frisbee golf. So it was always kind of misunderstood. And I was going down kind of to crew practice my first week at Harvard in 1979. And I was kind of ready to be a galley slave for the next 4 years. And I wasn't too happy with it. And then I saw a Frisbee flying across the street. It used to be Boylston Street. Now it's Kennedy. And I crossed the street and I went to Frisbee practice with these guys. And I learned that it was a running sport like football or soccer, and that you advance the disc through the air. And then I was playing with a guy who was the equivalent of a pro then. His name was Paul Edwards, or that's the name I gave him in the book. I changed his name. And he was kind of snooty, and I said in the book, if I'd expected to find snobbery at Harvard, I didn't expect to find it on the Frisbee field. And he criticized me a couple times. And finally I said, to hell with this, and I stormed off, heading back to crew. And my captain, the captain of the ultimate team, ran after me, tapped me on the shoulder, and I say in the book, he said the one sentence that would not only hook me and bring me back to practice, but keep me playing for 30 years, which was, you're going to be great at this. So he appealed to my megalomania, basically. Yeah. And for the next 20-some years, I first in college, then with what then were kind of the pro leagues, they were the club teams. And then I just went back last weekend and played in the Great Grand Masters in Denver. We got the silver, so we came in second.
Oh, wow.
50 and over for that league. It's a little slower.
And you know, you're right. When you think of Frisbee, you kind of think of people in the park throwing the Frisbee for the dog. And, and you don't think, or at least many people don't think of this fit, athletic person in this fast pace. I mean, these guys are and gals are in shape.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to be in shape.
I just did a piece for Outside Magazine on Bo Kittredge, who's one of the stars now. And he runs a 47 400, which is, you know, almost top level 400, a 4.440. And he went to a football combine and like crushed, basically. So there are, and the other thing about it is you've got these great athletes. I think we can get greater athletes. I mean, it's still going to get better. But the physics of the Frisbee make it potentially an exciting sport for the future, particularly with concussions, you know, pretty much eating away at football. So a disc hovers, which means running after it and diving, like you see a Major League Baseball player in the outfield, you can, it almost waits for you there sitting. And then 10 feet in the air, it hovers up there. So if you get these great jumpers, it makes for exciting moments. There was a bumper sticker when I played, which said, when a ball dreams, it dreams it's a Frisbee.
You write in the book, during my years playing, I was driven by a complicated mix of motives that included ambition, whimsy, love, and vanity. But it would be until many years later, when I had hung up my cleats, that I would start to recognize what I missed most about the game. What I missed most was not just camaraderie, but camaraderie with a purpose. Mm-hmm. Explain what you mean.
Well, I love the, you know, sense of purpose is a big part of what the book's about, and ambition is too. But the ambition I had at the time was to be recognized as a national champion. Now, recognized is a, you know, relative term here. I wouldn't be recognized on TV, but I'd be recognized within this world, within the subculture in which I lived. And so ambition drove me there. But it's not an individual sport. So, like, I had 14 friends on the team. And then when I moved to Boulder, Colorado, I suddenly had 20 new friends on a larger team. And the thing was, I thought what I needed out of the sport was to be recognized as this great player who won. And what I ended up getting out of it is being part of this tribe. And there's a real tribal sense to the game. There's a moment in the book where later on I find out, you know, I have testicular cancer, and I find out I have the good kind of cancer, and I have a party, and I look around the room, and 45 of the 50 people were ultimate players. So that was the community. That's really what I got. I just played last week, and I wasn't very good at 56. But the again, that sense of like hanging out with the team and being driven toward the same goal together.
And I think a lot of people would say that about whatever sport they're involved in. They're on the hockey team or the baseball team or whatever it is, that kind of sense of camaraderie. But I'm wondering, in this case, with ultimate, used to be Ultimate Frisbee, now called Ultimate.
Yes, exactly. It's
a different, it's because the sport is so not so understood.
Right.
And so you're kind of, as a team, you're kind of fighting a lot of these misconceptions.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And you know, people thinking, well, you're throwing a Frisbee around, and not right. It recognizing the sport that it is, and recognizing the talent goes into it.
Right, exactly. So in a way, the lack of fame, the lack of being known, is actually more of a bond with the team. I mean, I always said it was like the oral tradition. You know, we would, because back before I wrote this and before we were iPhoning everything, you only knew about the great plays from people telling stories. And they only knew about it within the community.
Right.
So I think for me, one of the epigraphs of the book is from Emerson. It's, whoso should be a man must be a nonconformist. I think for me, throwing so much energy into something that other people considered ridiculous was good training for writing.
Yeah, I guess you're right, yeah.
Writing books. I mean, there's a similarity there, particularly before you publish, mm-hmm. when the, you know, the rich guy at the cocktail party says, well, what do you do? And you try to say, well, I write. And what have you published? Oh, nothing. And then you tell them you play Ultimate Frisbee, yeah, and you're really in trouble. So I think you develop muscles of nonconformity playing the game.
I love the story in the book about your dad, who also went to Harvard, who I guess was not thrilled that you wanted to play, and goes to a game and ends up getting hit with the Frisbee.
Yeah, my dad, there's been a little bit of movie interest in the book, which has been fun. And I said my one stipulation is, I get to play my dad in the movie. I get to put a bald wig on and shave my beard off.
That's funny.
Because he had a gruff voice. And if I got a 98 on a test, he'd say, what happened to the other 2 points? And my first book, maybe the first time I spoke to you, was a memoir about my dad's death. And this is kind of a return to that subject. So he came out, and he was full of ridicule out of a football game, and he thought it was fine for people to play a sport with an oblong ball made out of pig. But a Frisbee, now that was ridiculous. So he was watching the game, and this player who looked, whose name was Nathan Salwin, and he looked a little like a Neanderthal, was roaming the field. And we used to say of Nathan, he had a notion, which meant he liked to huck it deep and as far and hard as he could. And he caught it near my dad, and I wrote, my father then should have had a notion that a primitive man from another tribe was right there, a dangerous man. So Nathan wound up, whipped it as hard as he could. The disc traveled 2 yards, hit my dad on the side of the head, and my dad went down. And I say at the end of that section, had I more Robert Bly in me, my symbol-making imagination would have seen this as what was going to happen in my life. The wild man within was going to destroy the businessman within, and Id was going to take down superego.
Yeah. So what is it that makes a good player?
The interesting thing is, if you had the very best athletes, you'd have 3 or 4 different types. You'd have handlers who are close to the disc, who are quick as hell, like point guards, mm-hmm. basically. And you'd have these middles who are explosive and jumping and running and sprinting. And you'd have deeps. You'd probably have power forward or small forward basketball players deep. That's for hucking, which is the Frisbee term for throwing long. So there are all kinds of different players. And one of the pleasures now is I'm getting to see that top-level athlete. I watched college national finals. And I teach at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. They were in the finals. And the year before, Harvard was in the finals. And I watched it in the same stuffed chair where I watched the Patriots Super Bowl. So it was on ESPNU. So it was like, oh, my God, all these years later, there's some validation here for this. Oh,
more than that, because there's talk about it being included in the 2024 Summer Olympics.
That
must seem mind-boggling to you, having come from the beginnings.
Yeah. I mean, I say in the book, we were the men in the leather helmets. And it's bizarre to have been there at the start. And now to see it really, you know, coming to fruition. And part of that is basketball didn't get included into the Olympics into the same relative age, about 50, that ultimate is right now. Mm-hmm. So it's like we were there, you know, it was just our little thing that we had privately, and now it's really kind of growing up.
4.5 million Americans played the game last year.
Excellent. And a lot of those were on Cape Cod.
Yeah. So we mentioned the first sanctioned game in 1968, but the first intercollegiate game was played in November 1972 between Rutgers and Princeton. And interestingly, on the 103rd anniversary of the first football game between the two, which you write is widely regarded as the first official intercollegiate football game.
Yeah. And that just shows that those early guys, the early ultimate players, had a marketing sense that my generation didn't have, because they got, you know, they marketed that mm-hmm. this is exactly where football started, now Ultimate's starting. And they got Sports Illustrated out, and they got the New York Times out, and Jim Boughton, who wrote Ball 4, was out there. So they had a huge crowd, and they thought at that day, this was, you know, they thought Ultimate was taking off. And as I say in the book, it took another 30 years for a crowd of comparable size.
So let's talk about this: how this game transformed from playing barefoot to mm-hmm. cleats and getting more serious.
Yeah.
Where did that change begin? When did it start to turn the corner?
Well, first we got to start at Columbia High School. And we can talk about Joel mm-hmm. Silver, the movie producer who invented it later. Mm-hmm. But It was essentially a geeky thing, not a hippie thing early on. It was played on their high school. The football team would come by and throw eggs at them. And then they took it out, the early players at Columbia High School took it out to the colleges in the Northeast. And it gradually started to get more organized and serious. And I came along in like 79, about the same time Reagan came along. And my decade was very Reagan-esque in the sense that winning suddenly became important, mm-hmm. and training became important, and people wore cleats, and there weren't co-ed teams. A women's league started up at that same time. And it was, you know, I used to feel like I would tell people I played Frisbee seriously, and it was like an oxymoron, but it really became this thing that was do or die. And in relation to the opening clip you played, during my time, I watched people take the spirit of the game, which is what we call making our own calls, basically, and use it to their advantage and use it poorly. You know, essentially, it was tough to have people training all year, teams training all year, getting to nationals, and then being fair. And you know, mm-hmm. when your team's fate depended on it, and one team in particular kind of took advantage of that, and almost systematically, it's not that they cheated, they just never gave up calls. And there were other teams like that too. So I think what's happened, a couple things have happened now that have made it more likely that spirit can work, except in the pros. One is everything's recorded on an iPhone. Mm-hmm. It's harder to be a cheater mm-hmm. when people see you being a cheater. People blog about it, and they identify the people who are bad apples as such in the blogs. And I think peer pressure has led it to be a fairer game. I also think I was always a cynic about Spirit of the Game, but I've come around in this sense. A current official of the USA Ultimate said to me, think of basketball where everybody's like faking fouls and, you know, and it's all about feigning and fooling a third party. Here, if it's between these two, that takes that away. Mm-hmm. There are observers that you can go to who make calls you couldn't possibly make, like whether your feet are in when you're scoring a goal. So I'm less of a cynic than I used to be, but I played during the dark days of the 80s when, you know,
anything goes,
winning mattered most. Yeah.
All right, so what do you want to say about Joel Silver?
I just think it's hilarious that he's the James Naismith of Ultimate. Joel, who is the producer of Matrix, Lethal Weapon, Xanadu, and other movies, was at Columbia High School, and he went to Geeky Smart Kid Camp at Northfield Mount Hermon, which is where I went to high school. And a kid from Amherst, Jared Cass, taught him this game. So he brought the Sacred Flame back to Columbia. He comically stood up during a student council meeting and said, I propose that we start a varsity Frisbee team. And the joke was that became a real thing. And they, he said at one point to another kid, he had his arm around him, someday they'll be playing this all over the world. And there was a mock element to it, but he was right, it turned out. So the next generation, just after him, I guess it's not even a generation, the next year, a really serious guy named Irv Kalb, who was called Dr. I, took the game to a new level. And he and his fellow graduates, Silver called them the Johnny Appleseeds. When they went to Princeton, to Rutgers, to Brown, to Hampshire, they took the game with them. And in the book, I compare that to the beginnings of Christianity. I say Silver was Frisbee Jesus, and these were the disciples. And it was similar in that they thought they had this beautiful thing no one had ever heard of, and they wanted to bring it out to the world. Yeah. So they did.
Not only wild on the field, Ultimate is famous for its crazy, wild, and loud parties. Is that still the case, do you think? I mean,
I've been asking that question doing a book tour, and it sounds like it's toned down some. And the irreverence has toned down some. But I know that a couple years ago, ESPN was filming the stands, which were made up mostly of Ultimate players, and they started chanting, not a real sport. So there's a self-deprecation you don't see in other sports. And I guess the most famous example in the book is when Jose Cuervo came in having made beach volleyball successful, right? And they came in and they said, we're going to do this with Ultimate Frisbee. And Ultimate Frisbee players didn't want to wear shirts with numbers, or they wanted to smoke joints on the sideline and be themselves. And then at the end of the tournament, Jose Cuervo opened the bar for free tequila for an hour, with Ultimate Players. So this was not a good idea. No, people at the end of the hour were crawling over the bar and grabbing bottles. And the executives for Cuervo kind of just shook their head and said, these guys are not ready for prime time. And my friend D. Rambeau, who was organizing it, said, if we can't sell this to a tequila company, who can we sell it to?
Yeah. So what are your thoughts about this being considered for the 2024 Summer Olympics? You think it's going to happen?
I do not have any insider information. I do know that they're pushing toward it being beach ultimate, which is also played at Old Silver Beach right up the way on Tuesdays and Thursdays, because it's cheaper and because if it's in L.A., that's a convenient thing to have. And they're pushing, and this is pretty extraordinary when you think of Olympic sports, for it to be co-ed, which would be really
fascinating.
That would
be great, yeah.
And it would kind of emphasize the community aspect of ultimate. I mean, so many of my friends are married to their former ultimate girlfriends. You know, I mean, I go back to these team reunions, and it's, you know, all these people I knew from my 20s. So I'm rooting for it. I don't know whether it's going to happen. It seems to me a natural for the Olympics because of the beauty of the game itself.
And I think you made a good point. It's definitely got to, I mean, it's certainly gaining in popularity. And with all of the talk of concussions in football and other things, you know, contact sports, this might be the time for ultimate to rise to the top.
Yeah, there's basketball-type contact in the game. You know, concussions do happen, but it's, you know, you're not consciously slamming into somebody. Right. So,
Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession, and My Wild Youth by David Gessner. David, thanks so much for coming and sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up after a break, folk musicians Bill Staines, Gordon Bach, and Cindy Callett join us.